For members only, Golf Smarter number 282, published on May 10, 2011.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Play your best golf now. Part 2 with Lynn Marriott.
This is Golf Smarter. Sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only, Lynn.
Hi, Fred. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has. And it's always fun to be with you and all your members. So great to be here.
Thank you so much. And it's what I love about having you guys on the show is I get, especially this time of year, I'll get a lot of books from publishers saying, will you do this interview? Will you do this interview? It's like, no problem. And your first two books were so awesome. I love them so much because they sang to me in a way that most books don't, that I was so excited to see that you were coming back. And what I find really interesting about your content versus swing mechanics books, you know, there's books that, you know, work on your swing, work on your mechanics. You integrate so much more than that. And after I read your book, my scores go down. And after I read a book that is instructional on the mechanics of a swing, my scores go up.
Well,
I don't know how to put that into a question, but how do you respond to that?
Well, no, and that's interesting because I think that actually parallels what we even see in instruction. That, you know, our vision and our goal at Vision 54 is to help people play better golf on the golf course. And to play better golf now. I mean, that's the title of our new book, Play Your Best Golf Now. And often when people go to take swing lessons, which is different than what we do, you know, they get knowledgeable about their swing, but they actually play worse. So, and you know, both of us are trained technical teachers. We have a long technical background and a deep technical background. But both of us found that people getting better golf swings didn't necessarily lead to better golf and lower scores. So, you know, at Vision 54, because we believe that somebody is going to shoot 54 or lower someday, and we're about performance, is that we started looking at what are all the things that influence a person's golf swing. And so that is how we came up with the 8 essential playing skills, because each one of those skills is directly influencing how good your swing or stroke actually is going to come out on the golf course. So I don't know if that answers your question or
I don't know if I asked a question, but
yeah.
So I was waiting for anything you had to say. It's not
okay.
A problem. Yeah, I have a friend that I was talking to on the phone the other day, and he was saying, you know, I was watching the Masters recently and watching people out on the driving range, and I just realized that I'm not going through the ball. I'm not coming through. I'm not following through. And I've been with him on the course, and he tinkers during an entire round. He tinkers with things thinking that he's done something wrong, and yet he'll beat himself up for a bad shot.
Yeah.
And so then what he does is he tries to work on his swing mechanics as if he knows what the nuances that well. And he may think that he does. I'm not sure that he does. I think that he really needs to start with his alignment and his grip and alignment type of issues before he even starts worrying on his swing. But I won't suggest anything like that to him. But I'm in no position to do that. But I just find it so fascinating that it's like, dude, relax. You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, that's where this thing is kind of what we think has been shrouded in mystery, is that most instruction or most coaching is only in the technical realm. And we're not trying to take that away. What we want to do is just add some fundamentals to the game. They go beyond grip, stance, posture, and then some dynamic swing theories. And, you know, we just want to build a better foundation for people to play better golf. So, like, going back to what I said, is that it's been shrouded in mystery. So somebody works really hard on their swing, and then that doesn't work, and then they keep thinking about their swing on the golf course while they're playing, And then somebody says, hey, dude, just relax, just trust it. And that's just like mysterious. Like they actually haven't practiced skills that create trust or that creates confidence. And again, that's what data essential playing skills are about, creating explicit skills that create trust, create confidence, that make your swing work on the golf course with the swing that showed up that day. And, you know, you make a really good point because we say it all the time, is that when you go to play golf, you've got to play with the skills that you have. I mean, if you don't like your swing or you don't like your stroke or, you know, there's a certain shot that you need to learn, you need to do that away from where you perform. You need to do that in a practice session. And then you need to know how to practice it smart so that it actually will transfer back to the golf course. But going back is that you've got to play with what, you know, what you have. And so then it's how to make that swing that you have and the skills that you already possess, how to make those show up and actually shoot low scores on the golf course. So that's what we're all about. I mean, Pia just read something this morning that a lot of people find that they're quitting the game because it takes so long to get better at it. And we want to take the mystery out of that. Because, again, where people have been is they've myopically been working only on technique. And that's an important part of golf, but it's not the complete game. So, and again, I'll just say this, the 8 essential playing skills, they're there to complement your physical and technical skills and your physical and technical practice. And we like to say that we're technically agnostic, that what we do at Vision 54 and the 8 essential playing skills will enhance any swing theory out there. We don't care what it is. It just needs to be a swing theory that fits you and a swing that fits you, and then these 8 essential playing skills will enhance that.
So you think you can work with any instructor, enhance any instructor's work when they've been working with someone on their swing mechanics?
Yeah, and Fred, actually we do. I mean, we work with some of the best swing teachers in the world in complementing or being part of the team with working with some of these best players in the world. So, yeah, you know, I mean, the only time it gets maybe tricky is if that swing teacher isn't open to that it's about performance on the golf course. If they just keep bringing it back to that it's only about technical skills and that the player needs to only work on technical, then it doesn't work. But as far as any swing theory, oh, you bet. I mean, I don't care if it's stack and tilt, rock and block, one plane, two plane, you know.
Hit it as hard as you can.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't, again, what we found, I mean, we make this point in our second book, and then we illustrate it a bit more in this book, Play Your Best Golf Now, that in picking a swing theory, you need to pick a swing that fits you, that has some part of your DNA or fingerprint already in it. Mm-hmm. And then it needs to be obviously a swing that you physically can do. So that's where, you know, the cat's out of the bag, is that the whole body swing connection is that if you're going to pick a swing theory, it needs to be something that you physically actually can do.
I appreciate that, because it seems to me there are coaches out there that are going to try to get you to match the perfect swing based on what they see on their little video machines and match you up and say, look, you need to get to this position. And yet that person, you know, who's 54 years old and you know, overweight and doesn't spend a lot of time on their flexibility, can't do that.
Right.
And so they're going to try to force you to get there. I mean, they're actually, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is that, those are the people that we get. They've been to all these other swing things, and maybe their swing's even gotten better, but then when they go out to play golf, it actually doesn't show up on the golf course. No, I mean, I'm going to just say this. I'm one of these people, is that I've been working on the sway since I was, well, actually probably from when I started golf at age 11. And you know,
I don't know why I'm glad to hear that.
No, but it's the truth. And you know, and
you're normal.
Yeah, and everybody's normal. I mean, to some extent, is that you just even look at the swings that were at the Masters. I mean, some of those young guys have gorgeous swings, Jason Day and Charles Schwartz, who won. I mean, you go, wow. But even Rory's swing is not what would be, some would say, technically perfect, you know. But the reason he didn't play well those last nine holes wasn't because of his swing. It was because he was a bit deficient in some of these other skills.
But, oh, I mean, just, boy, would I? Could we spend a whole hour on that?
Yeah, I mean, we could, too. I mean, we think it was a great display of, you know, I mean, Sunday's Golf at the Masters was a great display of what we do at Vision 54.
It was a great display of golf and the excitement of, you know, of what kind of excitement golf can generate.
Yeah. Oh, isn't that the truth? I mean, it was fun, you know, with Twitter and all that, just following the tweets and how excited people were, just saying this is the best Masters ever and what a Masters and I'm glued to my seat. And then when it was over, people were tweeting like, oh, I'm so sorry it's over. Right? Like, I don't want it to be over.
Hey, yeah, did you fantastic. Really, did you follow Twitter during the Masters?
Oh, yeah.
You know what? That's so interesting. It never crossed my mind. I was so engaged in watching what was going on, and the way they do it on television, the pacing is so quick. I never even thought of pulling out my phone or my computer to see what was being said on Facebook or Twitter.
Well, yeah.
It's the first time it's even...
Twitter is just, it's so immediate, and it's so short that it's not like this running commentary. It's just, you know... it was fun because it was just another level of commentary by people and fans and even players that weren't playing at the Masters with, you know, Paul Azinger.
Wow.
And yeah, it was great.
So that would have been fun to have that at the bottom of the screen, like, you know, how a CNN always has a crawl going on at the bottom. It's just to have selected Twitter, you know, commentary, like from different players and stuff, and just have that rolling on the screen while the announcers are painting these pictures that are like almost too cliche in some ways the announcers are doing.
Yeah.
That would have been fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yep. Well, I just wanted to say, going back to that, is
I'm
that,
sorry.
You know, back to the swing thing and the, mm-hmm. what did you say, 54-year-old?
Well, the number 54 keeps coming up. I'm just saying that, you know, I consider that my peers that I play golf with who are in their mid-50s or 60s, you know, or older 40s, maybe haven't been playing their whole life. They don't have time, or they think they don't. They choose not to spend a lot of time on their flexibility or, you know, their stamina. They don't walk the course. Those kind of guys that just, you know, they play because they love to play and they just want to get better with every single round, but they don't put the effort into it.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I'm going to say, is that we look at those people as like they're perfect candidates for exactly what we've written in this book. Is that with the skills they have and the body they have, and then that they're not going to be able to change either, okay, in a way that, like I said earlier, that's going to show up and hold up on the golf course. By just complementing the swing they already have and the physical shape they're already in with these eight skills, they're going to play better golf, and they're actually going to stay in the game longer. But if they go to a more traditional or conventional teacher that says, okay, we got to change your swing, or, you know, you've got to go to the gym 3 times a week, they actually, I mean, it becomes something that they may want to do, but in reality they're not going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, we've just found that. We, even when we've done physical screens, we've found players who they learn about what they need to physically do or do, you know, a physical fitness program. We write it all up for them. We set it up for them to do. You know, we even follow up, and we find out they don't do it.
Right.
No, because it's like all these other things. But these eight skills that you learn and play your best golf now, you can do right now.
Right. I mean, you give those people the assignment to do these things and go to the gym 3 times a week, and they're all enthusiastic about it to start.
Right.
But then it just like, that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to play golf better.
Exactly.
And then, actually happens in the podcast world, too. People come to me all the time saying, I want to do a podcast, except I want to do it. I can do it by myself, right? And I'm like, well, you can, but you really don't want to, because if you do it all on your own, then you're going to get caught up more in the production than creating the content. And I think you want to focus on the content. And if they do start it on their own, they fall on the wayside because, like, this is taking more work than I wanted to do. And it's kind of the same thing. It's more work than I wanted to do just to get to that end point.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. No, but I was, you know, we have, you know, with our golf schools and then the coaching that we do, we have week after week, we have people who come, and not that we're their last resort, but we're like, oh, I've tried all these other things. Now, you know, I've heard about you guys, I've read your books, and now I'm going to try this. And like we had a lady a couple weeks ago came. She was a vascular surgeon, lives in New York. Actually, she's in very good shape physically. She's, you know, an athlete. She's done a ton of technical coaching and, you know, instruction. But, you know, she's shooting in the 90s. And for the amount of time and energy she's put into this, I mean, she should certainly and could be a player that shoots, you know, as a single digit or into the 70s. And but all she's been doing is working on her swing. So when we came, and when she came, we pointed out to her that, like, a couple of skills that she wasn't very skilled in were, like, emotional resilience and tension awareness. And, you know, here she is a doc. She's a medical doctor. She actually has her medical degree from Stanford and, you know, didn't even understand that emotional resilience and her post-shot reactions were affecting her golf game. So it was pretty fun. I mean, we just got this email from her a couple of days ago, and she's like, hey, I'm amazing. I'm shooting in the 70s. I had a 78 the other day, and people can't believe I'm the same golfer. So that's the kind of thing we love, because if she stayed with the route she was on, only working on her technical skills, it wouldn't have gotten any better. You know, but now that she's addressed some of these, so to speak, gaps in her game and has looked at them as skills that she actually has to do. So for her, like her emotional resilience, her post-shot reactions, she actually needs to start counting immediately when the ball leaves the club face or putter face, because she can tend to get pretty angry, get herself into a state of cortisol, which just spirals down into, I mean, she also almost becomes a social misfit on the golf course.
Wow.
No, I mean, and people don't want to play with her, and she doesn't intend to behave that way. But, you know, and then her scores go up, and, you know. But she, so anyway, her skill, I mean, the small skill, but she's having to do it. Okay, you can't think about these skills. You actually have to do them. Is that when the ball leaves the club face or the putter face, she just starts counting to distract her emotional reactions so she doesn't, you know, spout off and get all angry about a shot that may be just good enough. It may not be perfect, but it's good enough. And she's able to keep herself, what we like to say, in the game, emotionally in the game. And that's going to show up in that your swing shows up more often down the stretch, or your putting stroke stays in the game down the stretch. And that's how you shoot lower scores.
Oh, you are... I'm just so glad that I'm getting this affirmation about the fact that you really can have a great impact on your scores through your emotional IQ on the golf course. That it just, swing mechanics is not just it. That it's no. It's so much more. Well, listen, on the last episode, we spent a lot of time with Pia talking about the book. Pia, of course, being the co-author and your business partner at Vision 54. And on all three books now, the Game Before the Game, Every Shot Must Have a Purpose, and now Play Your Best Golf Now. And I wanted to follow up with you on the last elements of the, you know, the eight essential playing skills. So why don't we pick it up with you? I think we finished up with number five, which was tame tension. Should we move on just to number six, or you want to take six, seven, and eight? And how do you want to?
Yeah, well, I already just spoke to emotional resilience, but I'll just say a few things about that,
right.
Fred, is that
which was number
emotional
six.
Resilience is, I saw this tweet, actually, from Graham McDowell called Bounce Back Ability.
Bounce
and that
back
was
ability.
During, no, honestly, that was during the last nine holes at the Masters on Sunday. And that's what emotional resilience is. It's bounce back ability. It's the ability to bounce back, you know, from a shot almost going into the Butler, you know, into the Butler cabin on 10. And obviously Rory didn't have it, you know. But it's something that can be seen as a skill. And it's what we like to say, it's about keeping your emotional state at a neutral to a positive level, and that actually has an effect on you hormonally or chemically, and that by staying neutral or positive, you're building a chemical base or a hormonal base where you're actually more resilient. And it's just in literally by having that emotional resilience, you have access to more or all of your abilities. And I'll just go to the other side. When you start to get yourself in a state of what they call cortisol, okay, and that cortisol is a hormone that gets secreted in the body when we have negative emotions. Whether those negative emotions are introverted or extroverted, doesn't matter. If people can see them or they can't see them. When you have those negative emotions and cortisol gets secreted into the body, it shuts down your higher brain functions. It literally makes you operate more at a mammalian and reptilian level in the brain. So your fine motor skills are compromised, your decision-making is compromised, your ability to see the shot or putt or the line. And Rory said that. He goes, I couldn't see the lines. He goes, and I couldn't get my speeds. Mm. All of that is compromised. I mean, it's a very chemical and physical, biological state that you can learn to create either way. So again, what we outline in the book, and it's a real skill, is what you do to build emotional resilience so you can keep your head in the game.
Well, as opposed to what Rory is doing after that number 12 drive, where his head was in his hands. I mean, you just saw a child that was defeated.
Yeah, and you look at the two. And in my opinion, the two best in the game with building emotional resilience, Jack Nicklaus and Annika Sorenstam. I mean, and then you just look at their records that, you know, they won a lot of tournaments when they weren't hitting the ball very well. Mm-hmm. And that's because they had the skill of emotional resilience.
Okay, so now you brought her up. I didn't. So since you worked so much with Annika, both you and Pia, I'm curious to know how much impact the two of you had on her emotional resilience, or did she already have that in the bag when she got to you?
Well, I often like to talk about that because, you know, when I actually will say this first about Jack Nicklaus, then I'll say about Annika.
Okay.
I worked for Jack Nicklaus Club Management right out of college, so I actually had an opportunity to be around him and Mr. Grout and his practice and, you know, his team and all that at a course called Frenchman's Creek in North Palm Beach. And he learned it implicitly. He didn't learn it as an explicit skill. He just had kind of a support team around him, his dad, Jack Grout, and others who just created kind of an attaboy culture for Jack where he just did it, and he didn't know he did it. Annika,
wait. What do you mean by attaboy culture?
Hey, Jack, that way to go, attaboy, you know, you're great. He always got pumped up. People did not, in his support team, did not talk about what was wrong with Jack or his golf swing or his golf game.
Well, but to me, with that kind of culture, and that goes with, in our society, it seems to go with athletes who excel at a young age, that there's always this, if we can call them an entourage around them, pumping them up, telling them how good they are. But on the golf course, you're all by yourself. So when things aren't going well on the golf course, how do those people that have that group around them, admiring them at all times, how do they get themselves to be, wait a minute, where's my affirmation here? I can't do it on my own. I need help with this.
Well,
on the golf course, it's different.
Yeah. I mean, Jack may be an enigma. I don't know, but he was able to do it. I mean, and I often said this, he didn't really know explicitly the skills that he did, that he actually was able to perform. But emotional resilience was definitely one of them. I mean, you even look at his comment when he won the 86 Masters and he's walking up 18, and, you know, the emotion was just enormous, you know. I mean, and he started to feel like it was taken over, and he said, wait a minute, I've still got to go up there and putt. Mm-hmm. That is a guy who did emotional resilience. Mm-hmm. He knew he still had to go up there and putt out, even though he'd won the tournament. So he did the skill implicitly. I was going to say, now, Annika learned at age 19 with Pia as her national coach with the Swedish national teams as an explicit skill. I mean, she just learned the science behind it, that there are really only two options to her post-shot reactions, either neutral, factual. You can be factual, like my ball went off the property or went out of bounds or that was my fourth putt. You could be factual about the result or outcome, or you could be happy. And just that skill, she said, that makes sense. And so as an explicit skill that she learned at age 19, I often like to say she took it to the bank. Literally. But it, you know, it's not rocket science, but you actually have to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, does that make sense?
Of course.
Yeah.
But you know, making sense is one thing. Putting it into practice is a different ballgame.
Yeah.
especially for a lot of us, you know, the golfer who just wants to get better and will do a lot of things like listen to podcasts and read books and subscribe to every magazine and buy DVDs off of infomercials and make sure I have the greatest and newest swing to aid that, you know, there's an infomercial about, you know, that's who we are, thinking it's going to help, but your books are saying there's a whole lot more to it than
and I'll just say this again, while we get so excited for golfers and the work that we do, is that if you just do these skills, and they're simple skills. I mean, Yanni Singh said it perfectly. We helped her last year at the British Open when she won her second major, and then also when she won in Arkansas in the fall, you know, with very simple techniques. But when you actually do the techniques and you see them as just skills like gripping the golf club or a skill like lining up a putt, those are skills. Mm-hmm. But if you see building emotional resilience as a skill and you go, okay, it's just something I do. And in our book, we outline exercises at the end of every chapter with each potential playing skill. Then it doesn't seem like it's you're going to the couch and doing sports psych stuff. You know, it's actually seen as a skill. And, you know, that's what P and I said, is that one of our goals is to take kind of this fragmented view that many players have of the game. Like, they go and they work on their long game, and then they go work on their short game. So they work on with long game coaches and then short game coaches and then sports psychologists and then putting coaches. And, you know, so it becomes very fragmented. What we want to do is bring it all back together again, kind of like Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall. We want to bring it all back together again so that what we do with the 8 Essential Playing Skills is about, these are skills that you do to perform better on the golf course. Mm-hmm. You know, rather than seeing it like, oh, I've got to go work on sports psychology or I've got to go, you know, train in the gym 5 days a week. You know, if you want to be an elite player, that may be a non-negotiable. But for many of the golfers out there, that's very much a negotiable.
Well, for many of golfers out there, as you would call it, and I think of it as us, being an elite golfer is just competing in the local, you know, the local competitions. If, in fact, you even want to do that, or even just winning the $5 on with your foursome is elite competition for some of us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and some people have misinterpreted sometimes Vision 54 as only working with elite players. But, you know, what we often say, your Vision 54 might be to break 100, or it might be to break 90 or 80. It doesn't matter for us. It's, you know, like you just said, it's your elite competition. It's what you're deciding to compete in at whatever level. But that, you know, that's your Vision 54.
Yeah. Yeah, let's get on to number 7 of the 8, store memories. Let's expand on that a bit.
Well, very simply, it's, again, about what we call creating confidence, and it's based on brain science, the neuroscience of how the brain actually stores emotional memories. And to keep it really simple is that, again, your choices with that are neutral, factual, or positive. And it's either the science of competence or it's the science of the yips. And, again, it's going to go in either direction depending on what you choose to do and how you understand this skill. But it's just that, you know, it's like when we walk up to a golf hole and we go, oh, I love this hole. Man, it just fits my eye. Mm-hmm. That's because you have a stored memory from that hole that says, I've had a good outcome here before. So you're flooded with the feeling, wow, I love this hole. And then, you know, the opposite is true. You can walk up to a hole and you go, oh, I hate this hole, and you start to grab for the water ball.
Oh, my favorite one is I always hit it in the water on this hole.
Yeah, so it's because you have a stored memory about that, and you're immediately flooded with doubt and hesitation,
sure,
and what we like to say, no signals. So when you understand that as an explicit skill, you start to take more care with what you store.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, then you just become the victim of randomness. And literally, if you store, I often say very simply, one way to neurologically create the yips is, let's say you have a 3-foot putt that you're really vested in making, whether it's for the club championship or the Masters, okay, it doesn't matter, and you miss that putt. And then you have this huge emotional reaction to it, and you replay it over and over again. Maybe you go into the clubhouse and you tell people, my God, it was just a tap-in, you know, and you go home and you tell the dog about it, and you store
you
it now
beat
once.
The dog
maybe,
about it.
Yeah, and maybe you store it now 100 times.
Yeah.
What that has become now in your brain literally is a very stored memory. In science, they call that a hot amygdala. That's the amygdala is where it gets stored in the brain. So now what happens, and this is basic science, and it's science, about the brain and how we're wired primally for survival, is that now I go out to play golf, maybe it's a week later, a month later, and I've got a similar putt, a 3-foot putt, and I'm vested, I want to make it. And before I even putt, my heart starts to pump, my hands start to sweat, I'm getting all choked up. I can't get any oxygen to my brain because my system, my brain goes, danger, danger. That's the primal wiring. So even though it's just a putt and you go intellectually, this is just a putt, your body's reacting like it's fight or flight. Yeah. And you do that enough, it becomes the yips. I mean, that's how Ben Hogan created the yips with his putter. So that wiring is the same if, you know, I run into a rattlesnake here in the desert in Arizona. All of a sudden, there's a rattlesnake, it's coming after me. And that gets stored in my amygdala. The next time I'm out there and my water bottle just kind of rattles, I think it's a rattlesnake. Okay? The brain is wired that way for survival, whether it's a rattlesnake or it's a 3-foot putt. So the wiring doesn't matter. It's what you do with it. And so that's, again, when we make this more of an explicit skill, you take great care with what you store. And I think, you know, going back to the Masters on Sunday, when Rory said in his post-interview, and Peter Costa said to him, you know, take a lot of positives out of this. And he goes, I am. He goes, you know, I played 63 holes really well and 9 holes not so well. What we like to call you're my 54 and you're not 54. And, you know, so he's already had some training in how to store his memories. And now it's how he actually deals with it this week in all the conversations that he's going to have, you know, and all the media interviews, how he's going to choose to store that thing. And we often say storing memories isn't about denial. It's just about being factual or positive.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense to you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Actually, my friends and I, when he did that interview and he said, I played 63 holes well and 9 holes not so well, we all kind of looked at each other and went, unfortunately, it was the first 63 and not the last 63. It's like, if you only would have flipped those around, kid, you would have been in great shape.
Yeah.
Oh,
I just, you know, with the work we do and, you know, how we see it, we're like, oh, he's actually got an incredible, incredible opportunity. If he can just get a hold of a couple of things that happened those last 9 holes, and really what started to happen in the first 9 on Sunday, but it really manifested by 10 and the 10th tee and that tee shot, there is great opportunity. I mean, honestly, we see that, you know, the way we look at it, because if he can just get a hold of a couple of these skills that are just outlined in the 8 essential playing skills, whew. Watch out.
Did you happen to notice, or was it just me, that in that post-interview, the post-game interview with Rory, one of the comments he made was, I knew Sunday was going to be tough. That kind of jumped out to me going, you've lost already.
Yeah, well,
How would did you respond to that? Did you hear that? And how would you react to that?
Yeah, I mean,
if you heard that.
I was going to say, I mean, yes, I did hear it, but I also think that he's being real. I mean, he's being real about his age and about the experiences that he's had.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that he knew it was going to be tough, that he'd never, you know, like he'd never experienced leading a major going into Sunday like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's actually, we often say to players, you know, when Suzanne Pedersen did this, very specifically, the first time she was leading a major was the Kraft Nabisco. And it was very similar, except for hers were 68 holes. And she had a four-shot lead, and then she lost it. Morgan Kressel won it. Well, you know, we helped her learn from those last four holes so that she could glean from those last four holes, 68 holes, and then those four holes, what was different. What I said earlier, my 54 and not 54. And like we told Suzanne, hey, you didn't know what it was like to lead a major. You'd never been there before. So, you can do all the learning prior to that, and you can talk about it, but there's nothing like being in the heat of the moment and learning from it. So what happened to her, and I hope this will happen for Rory, is that fast forward a month after the Kraft Nabisco, and Suzanne's at the LPGA Championship, and she's leading again. And she calls us on Saturday and she says, hey, I'm in the lead. And like, you know, she's of course thinking it could happen like it happened at Kraft Nabisco. I could lose this thing. And we said, yeah, it could happen, but what did you learn? And we went through what was different and how she was going to deal with that on Sunday at the LPGA Championship. And so she went out there at the LPGA Championship on that Sunday round equipped with some skills. Some post-shot things, what she was going to do between shots, that her decision and commitment was going to be 100%, that with her tension, she often manifests tension around her mouth and in her shoulders, and what she was going to do with that. So she actually pretended keeping a potato chip between her teeth. I mean, very simple, but it tamed the tension. Her post-shot reactions, she let him go really quick and started talking to James or caddy. And lo and behold, she won the championship. She won her first major. And the funny thing is, you know, when we talked to her, you know, later that night and then the next day, she said, you guys, yeah, I won my first major. It was so exciting. Like, it was really cool. But I didn't hit the ball very well. And we're like, yeah, but you won. And that's mm-hmm. the whole point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the opportunity Rory actually has with the 63 and the nine holes that he talked about. And, you know, he knew it was going to be a tough Sunday, of course, because he'd never been there before.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, the 19th hole conversation about Tiger can go on forever. but as we cover this topic here, what is your two cents on the fact that as great as his career has been, as difficult as he's of a time as he's having now, that throughout his career, he's never come through on Sunday when he's behind?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was enough of an answer. Thank you very much.
It's a loaded question. You know, I'm going to be honest, and this is the way we look at it at Vision 54, is that Tiger's, he's phenomenal. I mean, he's one of the best, if not the best player ever in the game. And he is still lacking in a couple of these skills. Hmm. He's still deficient in building emotional resilience. You could see that. That's why he responded like he did in that post-round interview with Bill McAtee. I mean, and he still...
I'm going to go have a sandwich. I'm starved.
Yeah, well...
With that smirk on his face.
And then, you know, taming tension. I mean, that one putt that he made... I mean, I'm sorry, that he missed on 15.
Oh.
If you go back and you look at that putt, and you look at the tension around his mouth,
yep.
And he was gritting his teeth,
yep.
You know, I mean, you know, he's great. But I don't think he still has as much tension awareness as he needs on the golf course. To get him down the stretch.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the group that I was sitting watching with, the one guy was going, oh, my God, he's got it. It's eagle. It's a gimme. It's like, no way, buddy. There's no way this is a gimme on this one. It's just,
no. It
was too tough. And you're right. You could see it around his mouth.
And around his eyes.
He was terrified of that putt, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, and I think it's just that... I think he, and this is again our opinion, but sure. I think he started to find his tempo coming into the Masters. So I think he was starting to really find that. You could see that even in his, even as he prepared in his think box before he went into his play box, his rehearsal swings were very slow mm-hmm. and very rhythmic. So he'd started to tame tempo and feeling his tempo. But the tension awareness, I think, has still kind of got him.
Mm.
And, you know, part of that could come from just that he's been going through this swing change, and it's taken a lot of physical work, so he equates that with tension. You know, when you look back, at the ad that Nike ran a few years ago, and it was that beautiful driver swing in slow motion.
Super slow motion, yeah.
I mean, it was gorgeous. It was such a cool thing to see.
Yeah.
Well, they actually filmed that swing in real speed.
Right,
of course. And it was just done with a very, very slow motion camera. But if you go back and look at that, you look at the tension around his mouth, there was none. I mean, his mouth and his jaw and his neck and his shoulders, very, very relaxed.
Well, he was also in a studio and it wasn't didn't count for anything. And he was hitting into a net.
Yes, this is true. So
I don't have any tension when I'm in that situation, too.
Yeah, but the thing is you need to be aware of where tension shows up. Where does it show up in your body? For some, it does show up, like I said about Suzanne, or we've been noticing with Tiger, it shows up around the mouth or around the neck and around the TM joint. For some, it shows up in grip pressure. So they might look all relaxed around their mouth and their neck and their eyes, but it shows up in grip pressure. So, you know.
OMG.
Yeah.
No,
you got it.
I just realized
right.
that I came back. Yeah, no. I just realized because I came back from a trip recently with some friends, and there were a couple photos of me swinging the club, and one really, I've been looking at it like, what the heck's wrong? I am gritting my teeth and biting my lips so hard, I never realized that's what it was, is that I'm like, you know, it's like I'm almost choking myself because of all the tension around my mouth.
Right. Well, I'll just tell you a little tidbit with that, and it goes with this skill of taming tension, is that TM joint, you know, up there in your jaw, when people get TMJ, it's so painful.
Yes, it
that
is.
That joint has more nerve endings on it than any other joint in the body. So when there's tension there, that is radiating out through your body.
Oh.
And last year, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there was a product put out called the PPM Mouth Guard. And it's now actually banned on the PGA and LPGA Tour because it's seen as a teaching aid, or a training aid, I should say. And very simply, what that mouth guard did was it put your jaw in a position where that joint was relaxed. And Major League Baseball pitchers were using it, and they're using it in NASCAR and all that, because it actually keeps the body in a more relaxed or less tension position.
Hmm.
So here's the easy way to keep. Yeah. So here's the way to keep that tension around your mouth at a place that's functional. Is that we learned this actually from a woman named Barbara Bonney. She's one of our time's best sopranos. She lives over in Provence. She came to our golf school. She's an 8 handicap. She actually is one of the players that we write about in our book. And Barbara Bonney, because her job is singing, and you cannot be tense in that joint, is that you put your tongue and rest it lightly against your bottom teeth. And that puts the jaw into kind of almost a underbite position. So your lower teeth are jutting out ahead of your upper teeth. And when the jaw is in that position, it's just like the PPM mouth guard that costs a couple $1,000s.
Hmm.
There you go, Fred.
There you go.
I'm
doing
easy.
That right now.
Yeah, that's so easy to do.
Yeah.
And now you've tamed tension in your swing that's going to help your swing with the swing that you've got.
Thank you. Very cool. All right.
Yeah.
So you know, these 30-minute interviews tend to go long sometimes when
I know. And
especially
I was
gonna say,
we've talked about actually building emotional resilience,
yep.
The storage of memories, and taming tension.
Yep.
Yeah.
Then
great.
Do we want to talk about practice, or do we, you know, I mean, it's like, this is a members only podcast, so I can go as long as I want on these. boy, we should just continue doing this. I love your stuff so much. I think your books are so great.
Thank you. There's
so much value in them, well beyond the mechanics, and we just don't need to go on. Do we want to do one more? I'll just say one more point.
I mean, the last essential playing skill, mm-hmm. I think, is one that, many isn't even on their radar, and it's called drowning your self-talk in useful thoughts. And why this becomes a skill that needs to be managed in golf is that when we're out playing golf, we're out there for 4 to 5, 5.5 hours sometimes, unfortunately, and that is a lot of time that you are with your own thoughts. Now, if you were running the 100-yard dash, you don't have to worry about the skill of self-talk. You know, that sport is over with quickly. But in golf, you're out there for, you know, hours on end, and actually you have a lot of downtime. You actually have 3.5 sometimes to 4 hours of actual downtime where you're not actually hitting a shot. You're just with your own talk with others. So we have found, it's been very interesting as we've looked into some of the research on this, is that learning to manage your self-talk and or distracting your self-talk when it's not so productive is, again, just a very simple skill, but an essential skill for you to play golf. And I'll just point out that, you know, last year, again, when we helped Yanni Tseng at the Ricoh Women's British Open and she won it, this was just a skill, very simple, but that she used to win that tournament and win her third major. And it was funny because she said between shots she was starting to think about and have self-talk around her rankings and how well she hadn't, you know, how she hadn't been playing well since she'd won at Kraft and how she was losing confidence and just bad self-talk. So we said, okay, Yanni, what are you going to do about it? And she said, well, I don't know. She goes, just give me something simple. We said, well, what do you like to sing? And she goes, well, I could sing Taiwanese children's songs. We said, perfect. It doesn't matter what you sing or what you say, but you need to distract that negative or non-productive self-talk between shots. So that was just one of the skills that she used, that when the self-talk would start to kind of squirrel away to something that wasn't productive, that would then affect her emotionally, which then would create bad body language, she'd go into kind of what we'd say her cave, and she wouldn't talk to her caddy. She would just start singing Taiwanese children's songs and distract the non-productive self-talk. Thank you. Another major.
So, book it.
And yeah, and it's a simple skill, but like I said, it's not one that's on many people's radars. But as people start to kind of understand it, that it is something that needs to be looked at in golf, because it's just the way our sport is set up over, you know, our sport takes 4 to 5 hours to play. So it's been fun to have players learn that skill and get immediate results. Mm-hmm. You know, Annika, when she won her last U.S. Open at Newport, you know, it's funny, when she walked off the 18th green on Monday, because she had to play a playoff with Pat Hurst, she said, oh, I wanted this U.S. Open so much. And she said, you know, it's been 5 days, but she said, I must have looked crazy out there because I just kept talking to myself to keep myself in it. Again, Annika had learned the skill of useful self-talk and a mantra that she often used between shots, just so that, again, the other stuff wouldn't come in and take her off into some made-up drama, is that she would just repeat to herself, fairway green, fairway green, fairway green, fairway green, between shots.
No, she was actually saying Freddie Green, Freddie Green,
Freddie
Green.
Oh,
you know, Annika and I go way back, and she was thinking of me the whole time. Well, you know, it's such an honor to have both you guys on this little podcast, because, you know, you not only have three amazing books, and again, they're on our website, The Game Before the Game, Every Shot Must Have a Purpose, and now the brand new one that's just been released, Play Your Best Golf Now, The 8 Essential Playing Skills. And you've been, you know, your golf school is ranked number one by Golf Magazine, and Golf Digest has named you the two top women teachers in America. It's, there's no doubt why, because of how you've synthesized all this information and can teach it. I'm just so honored that you were on the show, and I really appreciate your time.
And Fred, thank you. Thank you for having me. And we'd love to do it. You know, I'd love to do it again, and I know Pia would too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And yay. Again, tell everyone, I just want to make sure that everyone knows, vision54.com is your website. You can get a lot more out of that too. But get the books. They're so worthwhile. And they'll really, as I started out by saying, your score is going to go down when you read this book. And when you read a book on mechanics, it may go up.
So. Hey, well, that's exciting, because, I mean, our goal, one of our goals is for you to play your best golf now. Why wait?
Why
right?
wait? Thanks
Why
so
wait?
Much. Thanks yeah. so much, Lynn.
Yeah, thank you, Fred.
Up next, an incredibly detailed two-part discussion on the 1973 U.S. Open with the authors of Chasing Greatness, Johnny Miller, Arnold Palmer, and The Miracle at Oakmont. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.